This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. A new social media platform that customizes rituals and ceremonies for people who aren't religious is at the center of the new novel, The Startup Wife, by my guest, Tamima Anam. Also at the center of the story is the marriage between the two main characters, Asha and Cyrus, who co-found the app at the same time they fall in love. Asha came up with the idea for the app and designed it, but because her husband Cyrus is considered more charismatic, and because he's a man, he becomes the head of the new company. He gives daily talks to the app's followers, offering his thoughts about ritual and the meaning of life, and the followers start to think of him as a messiah. As the title of chapter 14 says, nobody wants to be married to the messiah. Some of the novel is based on what Tamima Anam observed in the tech world when she served on the board of her husband's music tech startup. Anam is also the author of a trilogy of novels set during and after the Bangladesh Liberation War, in which Bangladesh won its independence from Pakistan in 1971. Her parents fought for independence in that war. Her father went on to work for the UN and then started a widely read newspaper in Bangladesh, which he still runs. Anam's mother runs a human rights organization. Tamima Anam now lives in London with her husband and their two children. She's the recipient of a Commonwealth Writers' Prize and an O. Henry Award, and was named one of Granta's Best Young British Novelists. Her new novel has been recommended on a lot of summer reading lists, including in the Washington Post. Tamima Anam, welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed your book. And I'd like to start with asking you to read a short passage that I think will set the scene that the social media world is set in. So this takes place when the main characters are making their opening pitch to be part of Utopia, the startup incubator.
Thank you so much, Terry. I'm thrilled to be here. So I'm just going to read from the beginning of the book. Why don't we introduce ourselves? Leanne says, I'm the head of innovation here at Utopia. Hey, I'm Marco, says a man with deep-set eyes and a sharply trimmed beard. I created Obit.ly, a platform that manages all the social and public aspects of death. A woman with bright pink hair waves hello. I'm Destiny. I'm the founder of Consentify, a way to make every sexual encounter safe, traceable, and consensual. A thin, stern man in a lab coat leans against the table. My name is Rory. I run Lone Star. He speaks with a clipped Scandinavian accent. I want every single person in the world to stop eating animals. We would never fit in. First of all, it would be impossible to find a cute vitamin gummy way to describe the platform. And then the rest of it, the confidence, the hair, the way they all look as if they slid into place like a synchronized swim team. I cannot imagine ever being that comfortable in my skin.
So thanks for reading that passage from your novel, The Startup Wife. So now you should introduce us to the platform that your main characters create.
So the platform is called Y. It's pronounced Y, obviously, as in why are we here? But it's spelled W-A-I, which stands for We Are Infinite. And what it is a way for people to connect via rituals. So you go on the app and you tell it the things that mean something to you, your favorite cartoons, the food that you love, important experiences that happened to you in childhood. And then you ask for a ritual. You say, I want to get married, and for instance, in the book, there are these two classicists that get married. So they have a Homerian wedding ceremony. And that's what the platform gives you. And then you get to connect to other people via those rituals. So it's kind of an anti-social media, in the sense that you're not talking about superficial things. You're connecting via the rituals that give your life meaning.
And this is a platform that creates rituals without the baggage of religion. So it's a kind of secular rituals for people who don't have religion in their life but still want ceremonies. Do you relate to that?
I do, actually, because I'm not a religious person myself. But I can see how having a kind of organizing construct can be so relaxing in the world where there are so many uncertainties, and giving people something to hold on to, giving these kind of moments of punctuation in your life where you're looking forward to something, the baptism of your child, a bar mitzvah. You know, we don't have that as people who don't necessarily adhere to a particular form of religion. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could give atheists the same kind of scaffolding that religious people have.
Of course, things go terribly wrong in your book with this app. I'll leave that to readers to find out exactly what happens. But how did you come up with the idea for this app? I mean, we'll get into this later, but you're on the board of directors of an app that your husband created, so you know something about the social media world.
That's right. So, I mean, in a way, it was a literary device because I wanted to give the two main characters, Asha and Cyrus, a startup that was very unconventional because neither of them are your typical startup founders. They don't come from Silicon Valley. They're not natural entrepreneurs. And so I wanted to give them something that to them felt very countercultural. And the fact that it becomes a startup is almost accidental. And that does mirror my own life. So my husband and I were going to be academics. I mean, I was going to write novels and he was going to be a professor of Chinese philosophy. And then he invented this thing, which is in fact an app that works with a keyboard. And he started this company. And I feel like the whole journey has been one of kind of discovering the world of startups, sort of from an outsider's perspective. And that's exactly what Cyrus and Asha do.
So the startup incubator they become part of, Utopia, is among other things a way to attract funding from venture capitalists. But Utopia is especially interested in apps for the post-world world. In other words, they're preparing for some kind of apocalypse. It could be climate change, it could be war, it could be anything that would end the world as we know it. I understand that you started a fake website for Utopia while you were writing the novel, and you actually got interest from people. Tell us more.
So one of the really fun things about writing this book is that I got to make up all these sort of crazy startups that would probably, I mean, I don't know, some of them might exist in the real world, some of them might not. And then once I had done that, I got a designer friend of mine to create this website. And occasionally when I've been talking to people in the startup world, as a joke, I will just give them the website address and not tell them that it's fake. And there has been some interest, and the company that gets the most interest is the one that's called Empty, where rather farcically, you subscribe to nothing. You get an empty box every month and you get to put your baggage into the box and send it back to this company and they get rid of it in a responsible way. So let's say you're getting divorced, you put your wedding ring in it and they kind of, you know, incinerate it for you. So for some reason that has been the one that people are most interested in investing. But yeah, that's kind of like a little joke that I sometimes like to play on people.
That's crazy. You could just give it away to the Salvation Army or your local thrift store or throw it away.
Well, I think that you're touching on something, which is that one of the things that startup culture does is that it takes something that is very familiar to you, that you feel that you already know what to do. You know you can send your junk to the Salvation Army or put it in recycling, but it somehow is there to create an idea that you can make things in your life easier or more seamless or more meaningful by in somehow engaging in the startup. So, you know, there's all kinds of apps that have, there's one where they send you laundry capsules in your letterbox. Putting things in letterboxes is like a big thing right now. So flowers in your letterbox, your laundry detergent, your tampons, you know, so we know that we can just go out and buy them, but there are startups that are devoted to packaging your everyday activities in slightly different ways and creating businesses out of them.
So are you interested in the post-apocalypse world?
Well, I think right now we're all interested in the post-apocalyptic world because we're kind of living in it. You know, I wanted to give Utopia a slightly different sort of flavor than most tech incubators. And I've been to some of these co-working spaces and to some of these incubators, and there's a lot of hype and a lot of promise and a lot of talk about community. And I just wanted to give it that edge, which was, you know, they were thinking about this other world, and that was kind of bringing them all together. And Utopia is also a place where Asha gets to meet other female founders. And she builds these friendships with these other women who are coming up with all kinds of businesses. There's the Silent Vibrator. There's Consentify, which is about, you know, pre-agreeing to all your sexual activity before you engage in it. So I wanted to give her that. And so I put her in this place, which is called Utopia and has a lot of the elements of what you might imagine is like a perfect world, is imagining a world that is better than the one that sort of gets obliterated by an apocalypse.
But I am wondering if you grew up with a fear of the end of the world or of war. I mean, your parents fought in the Bangladesh War of Liberation. So war was the memory background of your life. I don't know how much they told you about it. And your father worked for the UN for years, and the UN is all about creating peace because there's so much war. So I'm just wondering if that was a part of your, you know, your nightmares or your fears, or if you read a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Terry, and I hadn't really thought of it that way. So I grew up hearing stories about the Bangladesh War. It was very much the thing that we talked about around the dinner table all the time. My parents had been in the war. It was the sort of organizing principle of their lives. And the other thing is, I come from a country where this kind of sense of apocalyptic possibility is always in the air because the climate is so extreme. And so it has always felt very much like a fragile place that was born out of this brutal war, you know, that it sort of barely survived, and then trying to beat the odds. And now, obviously, that big sense of apocalyptic change is climate change, which is going to affect Bangladesh more than many other countries in the world in a really extreme way. So for sure, I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, but the sense of the end of the world being very close has certainly been something that I've grown up with.
Yeah, that was probably a part of your life, even in your early childhood.
Yes. I mean, my parents, you know, so I was born 4 years after the war ended, and my parents both came into political consciousness in the 60s. They were revolutionaries. They were nationalists. My father fought in the war. And it was definitely something that played a huge part in the way that I was raised. And then we left Bangladesh when I was 2 years old because my father got a job with the UN. And I think that because we were far from home, I heard those stories even more. And I think that people who stayed in Bangladesh possibly were more on the sort of, well, this war happened, we need to move on and try to sort of get over the past. But for them, it was something that they really held on to and they talked about a lot. And they didn't just talk about it in sort of tragic terms and saying, you know, how awful it was, which it was. It was an extremely brutal war and millions of people were killed and millions of women were raped. But they also talked about it as this moment where they, as young people, got to imagine a country into being. And that was incredibly inspiring and important for them. And it was, like I said, it was the sort of foundational moment of their lives. And so I think a lot of the way they brought me up and a lot of the things they talked about and their relationship to each other was kind of built around that experience.
You've been a judge for the Man Booker Prize, which is Britain's most prestigious literary award. Is it hard to sit in judgment of fellow writers? I'm wondering if you ever meet any writers who you voted against for the prize. And they wouldn't necessarily know that, but I could see how awkward it would be for you.
Well, luckily, I judged the Man Booker International, which is for novels in translation. And so,
oh, God, yeah, you're lucky.
I didn't know a lot of those writers, but I can tell you, Terry, when I, being on the other side of that and having, you know, other friends who are on judging panels, and it certainly is part of that world, which can be very awkward. And I remember sitting in that room judging that prize and feeling extremely passionate about the kind of book that I wanted to win. And it gave me a little bit of perspective on, you know, why I hadn't ever been on one of those lists or sort of what happens behind the scenes. So in a way, it was made me feel a little bit better about possibly the times when I hadn't appeared on any of those lists.
So why do you think you were not on those lists?
Well, because it's a very subjective thing, judging. You know, what is brilliant to one person is not brilliant to another person. One of the, you know, I'm talking a lot about anxieties and insecurities, but I think one of the concerns that I had when I sat down to write this book was that it wasn't serious enough, that I had written a trilogy of novels that were, in a way, the kinds of books that you would expect from a person that comes from where I come from. You know, dealing with the big historical ideas of religion, talking about social change, talking about revolutions. You know, this is the kind of story, those are the kinds of stories that I feel I was expected to write. And I'm really proud of them. And I didn't feel that there was any something more urgent that I had to say. But when I sat down to write this book and I knew it was going to be a satire, I knew it was going to be a comedy, I thought, gosh, will anyone ever take me seriously again? And, you know, will I be one of those people that wins prizes, or will I be one of those people where it's like, well, she wrote something and it was lighthearted and joyful, but it's not serious. And that was something I really had to overcome. In fact, I asked my agent to send the book out under a pseudonym.
Why did you end up not using the pseudonym?
Well, she persuaded me not to, and my editor persuaded me not to. And I just kind of had to own what I had done. You know, I had to decide that it was serious and that I was tackling all these issues of, sexism in the workplace and the future of technology and what happens to a marriage when the man gets celebrated and the woman gets left behind. And these are all things that have preoccupied me. I am a feminist killjoy. and these are things that have preoccupied me in my whole writing life. They're just told in a slightly different tone. And I just had to become comfortable with that, I guess.
What was the name you were going to use if you used a pseudonym?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. So everyone in Bangladesh has a nickname. People have these very serious, you know, Arabic proper names that are on their passports. And then there's something that people call them at home. And my father named me after the Rosetta Stone. And in Bangladesh, everyone calls me Rose. So I was going to call myself Rose Lanam. And Lanam is the name that Roland and I gave to our children because it's a combination between our two last names. So Lam, he's Lam, I'm Anam. So our kids are Lanam. So I was going to call myself Rose Lanam. And she was my alter ego. I didn't just think of her as a pseudonym. I thought of her as the person I had to become in order to write that book.
Why did you have to become somebody else? Because let me just say, I think in some ways this might be your most autobiographical book, because your other books are more about people who lived in Bangladesh. One of the books is more about your father's generation. But this is about, it's about your generation. It's about a woman of Bangladeshi descent, the daughter of Bangladeshi immigrants who grows up in America, who's married to somebody that they have a startup like your family does. I mean, there's so many similarities.
Yes, I agree with that. But I had to summon Rose Lanam so that I could write all the dirty jokes, Terry. They don't
really
come easily to me. I mean, I had Asian parents. And I think that sort of loose, confident, sassy, lots of F words, that kind of language does not come easily to me in a sort of public way. If you and I were just hanging out and having dinner, I would certainly speak in Rose Lanam's voice. And so in a way, you're right, she is much more me. But to summon her in a public way, to bring out all of that, it just took for me to have the confidence to put into writing what I was putting into, like, my text messages to my girlfriends. You know, that sort of tone, that sort of satirical, funny, irreverent tone. It took a little bit of unlearning some of the limitations I felt that I had in presenting a public self.
Does this mean you're concerned about anybody in your family reading it?
I'm not concerned, although my mother said to me, because I had written to some friends, or I put in a Facebook post, you know, this book has a lot of curse words in it. And she literally said, what is Baro Mama going to say? Baro Mama is my eldest uncle. And I said to her, if I sat down and thought about what Baro Mama was going to say, I would never write another word ever again. It is a little bit of that, Terry, but it's also that when I was growing up, my father, the term third world country was very much an okay thing to say in the 70s when I was growing up. And my father would say to me, you come from a third world country, you have to get people to take you seriously. Everyone's going to not want to take you seriously. And your job is to get people to take you seriously. And I think part of wanting to do a PhD, even though I knew I wasn't going to be an academic, it was about that wanting to bring a kind of gravity to my self-presentation. And I had to slightly unlearn that when I was writing this book. And then I had to have the confidence to say, okay, this is still serious, even though it's full of jokes.
Well, I'm glad you unlearned what you had to unlearn.
Thank you, Terry.
You've referred to finding your voice and power as a woman. Were you encouraged to do that by your parents?
I definitely was, and they were way ahead of their time. I was the first girl born into my dad's family for three generations, so there had only been boys. And my father tells the story of how, you know, when people would come and see me as a baby, they would say, oh, we have to find her a prince or something to marry. And he basically banned that. He said, when you look at my nephews, why do you say, oh, he's going to grow up and be a barrister? Because, you know, at the time in Bangladesh, being a barrister was like the highest thing you could aspire to. He's going to be a barrister or a doctor. Why don't you say that to my daughter? And he really angered a lot of the relatives who would come and see me because he was so, you know, he basically put a ban on talking about things like marriage as something that I should aspire to. And my mother has been a lifelong feminist activist. So I think that I had the privilege of growing up in a family where these things were absolutely taken for granted and where conversations about equality and about feminism were right at the forefront of, you know, so present in our lives. And I'm deeply grateful for that.
It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. I really want to thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thank you, Terry. It's been an absolute thrill. I'm so grateful to you.
Tamima Anam spoke to us from London. Her new satirical novel is called The Startup Wife. The new six-part series, Schmigadoon, from Apple TV Plus, is a TV musical that uses the Broadway musical Brigadoon as a launching point. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has this review.
You don't have to be a fan of musical theater to enjoy Schmigadoon. The plot and the fun are easy enough to latch onto. Keegan-Michael Key and Cecily Strong play Josh and Melissa, two New York doctors who have been a romantic couple for a few years now. While on a remote hiking trip, they accidentally wander away from the group and end up in a magical, old-fashioned town where everyone breaks into song from time to time. It's a world from which the new visitors can't escape, at least not until they find true love, which, apparently, they're not experiencing at the moment with each other. Even if you don't recognize the story of Schmigadoon as a playful variant of the 1940s Broadway musical Brigadoon, there are some excellent TV precedents that you might know. NBC's recent Zoe's Extraordinary playlist served up a delightful weekly musical series in which the central character imagined those around her suddenly bursting into emotionally revealing song and dance routines. A classic episode of the TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer did a similar thing, involving a curse that had everyone communicating in song. And I can't help mentioning the mind-blowing musical miniseries by Dennis Potter, whose dramatic masterpieces, Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective, showed just how much you could do with recycling old musical recordings from the 30s and 40s. In Schmigadoon, the characters of Josh and Melissa, it's quite clear, aren't exactly fans of the musical genre. But the show's creators and writers, Ken Doreo and Cinco Paul, certainly are, and that informs every single scene. Not only the music and lyrics, but the way the numbers are staged, choreographed, and even cast. So when Josh and Melissa first stumble into the town of Schmigadoon, they're met with people who look like the townsfolk of the Music Man, gather around the new visitors like the munchkins surrounding Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, and sing a proud welcome similar to the opening of Oklahoma. It's a lot to take in at once, but it all works. Especially with Josh and Melissa acting understandably confused.
Okay, what is this? Now, why is music coming from everywhere?
Welcome to our little town,
where friends are all you'll meet,
and you will never see a frown.
Hey, everyone!
Hey there, Pete! You're probably wondering what we call the most beautiful, wonderful
happening.
It must be something they do for tourists, like Colonial Williamsburg.
Barry Sonnenfeld, the director who made the Men in Black movies and ABC's Pushing Daisies so entertaining to look at, does the same here. And the supporting cast is loaded with Broadway musical veterans who make the most of their respective turns. Alan Cumming from the superb revival of Cabaret plays the town mayor. Pushing Daisies co-star Kristen Chenoweth shows off her massive Broadway skills by doing a number playing off Robert Preston's high-energy Trouble song in The Music Man, and does it, astoundingly, in one unbroken camera take. And Martin Short has an obvious blast, playing a leprechaun who appears from nowhere to start Josh and Melissa on their journey, while singing a song that's 100% exposition.
Once ye have entered Shmigadoon, 'tis true ye won't be leaving soon. Within its borders ye are bound, until at last true love ye found. But till ye find it, ye must stay where life's a musical every day.
Was that a leprechaun?
Yes. He said something. What did he say?
I don't know. I was more focused on how he was shattering my whole construct of what's real and not real in the world, because he was a freaking leprechaun.
This new six-part Apple TV Plus series also features very strong turns by, among others, Fred Armisen and Dove Cameron. The performances, the script by Dario and Paul, the songs by Paul, the choreography by Christopher Gattelli, the direction by Sonnenfeld, each element feeds off the others. Shmigadoon is produced by Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live, and current cast member Cecily Strong and recent guest host Keegan-Michael Key really pull this off. Shmigadoon is being described as a parody, but it's a lot more sincere and complicated than that. Like such tongue-in-cheek Broadway musical comedies as The Book of Mormon and The Producers, it's a lovely production that's not only very, very funny in making fun of the musical genre, but also is a wonderful addition to it.
You might remember our next guest, C.C. Sabathia, as the dominating left-handed pitcher for the Cleveland Indians and the New York Yankees. He was a towering figure on the mound, often with his cap tilted over his right eye. Sabathia was a six-time All-Star, a winner of the Cy Young Award, and a starter for the Yankees team that won the 2009 World Series. He's one of only a handful of players to win 250 games and notch 3,000 strikeouts, numbers that will probably land him in the Hall of Fame someday. But Sabathia fought some demons in his 19 seasons in the big leagues. He was an alcoholic for 15 of those years, somehow managing to be sober when he took the mound, and drinking himself into oblivion and often fisticuffs much of the rest of the time. Sabathia tells the story of his youth, his baseball career, and his turn to sobriety in a new memoir written with Chris Smith. It's called Till the End. C.C. Sabathia retired from baseball after the 2019 season. He co-hosts the R2C2 podcast with sportscaster Ryan Rucco. And you can see a documentary about his life called Under the Grapefruit Tree on HBO. C.C. Sabathia, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you.
You grew up in Vallejo, California, in a neighborhood called The Crest, and you write that when, you know, later in your career, when big leaguers would come with you to visit the old neighborhood, they would say, man, this is a rough neighborhood. Did it feel that way to you as a kid?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't, that way to me. You know, it didn't feel that way. It was always,
you know, home, you know, was always a safe place for me. I mean, outside looking in, it could be, you know, you could feel like it's a rough place, but, you know, when that's your home and, you know, all the people, you know, there are, you know, either related to you or know somebody that knows your family, you feel safe in those communities.
Your dad left when you were, I think, 12, right? You were an only child.
My parents split up when I was 12, yeah.
When you were 12. And your grandmother's house was kind of a center of gravity for you. Your mom worked an awful lot. Grandma was a big force in your life. And she and both your parents, as you tell it, saw you early on as somebody destined to be a pro ball player. How did that shape your experience growing up?
It just, you know, that just made me believe. You know, my grandmother and my dad, you know, just from jump, you know, believed in my dream and, you know, would only let me do things that would fuel, you know, being an athlete. So that just gave me the belief right away that I could go out there and, you know, pull this off or, you know, be able to make it, you know, from Vallejo to the big league. So, you know, they were convinced that this was going to be my life. So it made me, you know, really think that, you know, this is where I would end up.
Did they coach you?
My dad coached me. My dad coached me a couple years. You know, he spent a lot of time with me out in the yard, obviously, you know, working on skills and different things like that. My grandmother was supporting a different way. She came to every game. She didn't miss a game up until she passed away my senior year, whether it was football, basketball, baseball, everything. I mean, and, you know, she was literally at every event that I had, she was there to support.
Another little detail that just I loved, you know, you said when you were younger, your mom would actually catch for you when you were a pitcher, and then you got to where it just you were throwing too hard. She didn't want to do it anymore. But she lived with you for a time when you were pitching at Cleveland, and you would stay up after a performance and go over specific pitches with her. She would give you advice?
Yeah, yeah. She lived with us a lot of the time in Cleveland. And, yeah, I mean, that was her thing that she really liked to do was, you know, go over games and, you know, try to figure out, you know, what pitch I was throwing and why and different things like that. You know, so, you know, that was always a lot of fun because, you know, she loves baseball. She's got a baseball mind and, you know, to be able to talk the game with her. And even my dad, too, you know, the first couple years when, you know, he came back to Cleveland, you know, we would sit out there in the garage and just talk about the game.
Another thing you mentioned is that, you know, I mean, you were always a big guy and you loved to eat even when you were a kid. And, you know, your weight could range from, what, 250, 260 to over 300. When you managed to lose weight, what did it do to your pitching?
When I lost weight during my career, I wasn't really effective. You know, couldn't throw hard, didn't have anything behind my pitches. You know, I think we all figured out, you know, as far as being a Yankee, that I pitched better when I was, you know, anywhere from 290 to 310. You know, anywhere in that range is where I could, you know, figure out to pitch well. And but as I got older, you know, that got tough to, you know, to be able to pitch with all that weight and, you know, obviously having, you know, knee issues and different things. You know, it just kind of had me limping towards the end. But, yeah, I mean, when I did try to lose weight, it didn't go well.
Yeah, mass equals gas was the expression.
For sure.
I remember there was a relief pitcher, Al Holland, for the Phillies, years, I guess before your time, but I remember he was a big guy. And one year he came into spring training, thin, athletic, felt great. He said his fastball had nothing. It's kind of puzzling, isn't it? I mean, you're not throwing with your body core, are you? Well, I guess you are in a way.
Yeah, you are. You do throw with your core. You throw with your body, and then your arm just kind of lags behind. So the bigger and stronger you can be in your body, that's why you see the bigger pitchers always pitch well and pitch longer and, you know, have the longer career because, you know, they have the bigger body and the bigger frame to be able to handle, you know, 200 innings a year.
You know, I think of Major League Baseball as having lots of black players, not so many as I read your book. I mean, did you feel underappreciated, alienated from white players in the clubhouses you were at?
Yeah, I mean, when I first came up, there were a lot of, you know, a lot of black players in the league. I mean, even throughout organizations, you know, and as I got, you know, older in the big leagues, you know, there was a shift, you know, there was a couple years in Cleveland where I was, you know, the only guy on the roster. And that could be tough, you know, obviously, you know, you don't feel alienated, but there's just nobody that in there for you to, you know, to relate to and, you know, talk to about different things. And, you know, I do. I mean, I have a lot of, You know, my best friend in the game is white. His name's Dave Risky. He's literally my best friend in the game. But, you know, there are times when, you know, you would want to have somebody in there that you could relate to and talk to. And, you know, you're going through a whole, you know, 8-9 month baseball season. You know, that's really hard. And, you know, it's based in failure. So, you know, to have somebody that you can hang out with and relate to makes a huge difference during the baseball season. And, yeah, I mean, it's the numbers are down right now. Hopefully we can get them back up to where they were when I was a kid watching the game. And even where they were when I was a young player in the big leagues. That's the goal of mine is to get more kids and to get more guys back into the big leagues playing baseball.
You write in the book that you had a group text of all 72 active black major league players. Did you build that? What was this used for?
No, this was something that, you know, we had for a long time had been trying to, you know, put something together like we have right now with the Players Alliance. And even Tony Clark, while he was playing, he's the president of the Player Association. While he was playing, he was adamant on, you know, making sure that we was all connected and stay connected. And, you know, he had made sure everybody got their email addresses out and put us all in the group chat. And this was before, you know, we even thought about coming up with the Players Alliance in 2020. So, you know, in a way, we've all been connected. But now, you know, having the Players Alliance and guys seeing the benefit of us really doing stuff collectively, it feels good.
When you went to the Yankees, you were a free agent, and you got a contract, $161 million for 7 years. At the time, the largest guaranteed contract ever for a big league ballplayer, I think, right?
No, for a pitcher.
For a pitcher, okay.
Yeah.
A lot of money. And, you know, you were very connected to a large extended family and had social relationships. Who had needs? How did that kind of wealth or the perception of that wealth affect those relationships?
Yeah, it made it hard. You know, I think when people see, you know, you get a big contract, they think you have that amount of money on you right then. And, you know, everybody wants, you know, something or see what they can get or trying to figure out if they can get something from you. So that made it difficult, you know, trying to navigate that. But, you know, having my mom around to try to figure out everything, my wife was huge in that, you know, helping us, you know, kind of navigate that field. And really being in New York, I think, you know, had we landed on the West Coast, it would have been harder, you know, but being in New York, kind of being so far away, it kind of helps you detach a little bit.
So let's talk about alcohol. I mean, you were drinking heavily through most of your years in the big leagues. When did alcohol become a major part of your life?
I think it was always a major part of my life. I think, you know, and I think that's a problem. Not, I mean, you know, it's a problem for people that's alcohol dependent. You know, alcohol is at every celebration. It's at every, you know, somber event. And I think, you know, for me, I had to examine my relationship with alcohol. And that's, you know, I had to take a look at it and understand that, you know, yeah, alcohol is such a big part of our society. And it's you know, a big part of what a lot of people do, but it just can't be a part of my life because I am dependent on it and I can't just have, you know, a drink or two, you know, it turns into 20. So understanding that, you know, was something that took me a long time.
Right. I mean, people get into alcohol because it's fun for a party. I mean, people also self-medicate to deal with tragedy or trauma. And you had some. I mean, you had your cousin Nate was killed at the age of 25. You lost your grandmother. You subsequently lost your father and a very dear cousin, Demetrius Davis, who was a guy you'd looked up for a long time. Do you think that part of this was rooted in trauma?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think, you know, just even at the time when I took my first drink, I was 14 years old, and, you know, my parents had just split up. My cousin was just murdered, and my grandfather had just passed away. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I think even, you know, my very first drink I took was to get away from, you know, all the trauma that I was experiencing.
You know, it's kind of amazing to think that an elite athlete can do this and still perform. Tell us what your routine was for drinking and getting sober as over the course of a season.
I would pitch. I would drink, you know, that night, the next day, and the day after that. And then I would take 2 days off, pitch, and then do it all over again. So it was, you know, kind of a cycle where, you know, it was 3 days on, 2 days off. And, you know, I did that for the longest time and you know, thought it was normal. So, you know, even so much where when I went to rehab, you know, I didn't know if I was going to be able to pitch without it. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it literally did just become a part of my routine.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing because, you know, we're not talking about a little bit of drinking. You would drink heavily. Like the minute you go off the mound, right, you'd have Sprite and Royal Crown in the locker.
Absolutely, right away.
Yeah, and then so you drink heavily for a couple of days, and then you detox. I mean, gosh, what can't have been easy? That's painful, isn't it?
It wasn't. You know, it was just one of those things where it was like I said. I mean, I had normalized it and got used to it, and you know, would go in and do my cardio and sweat everything out, and you know, and be fine. You know, I thought the more that I sweat, the better I was getting it out of me. So. Yeah, I mean, it was just all a part of the work. It was all a part of the routine. And like I said, I had normalized all of it.
The bottom for you, the big turnaround, came right before the Yankees were going to go into the playoffs. And this was, you know, this is well into your career when you weren't the overpowering fastball pitcher you were. You were using more pitches. And, you know, it was a different point in your career. Tell us about that, the bottom. It was on a trip to Baltimore, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, we were on a trip to Baltimore, it's the end of the season, and I think we had just clinched to go to the playoffs that Thursday night. I pitched a pretty good game. We played against Boston, and I didn't drink during the celebration. We had the big celebration, and I didn't drink at all. And, you know, we got on the bus to go to Baltimore. Somebody handed me a bottle of the Hennessy, and I drank that before we even got into the plane. And, you know, just kind of set me on a course that weekend where I didn't really stop drinking from Thursday to Sunday. Sunday, I had a bullpen that I was supposed to throw to get ready for the playoffs. And, you know, I go in, and right away, as soon as I get to the stadium, I just grabbed a drink and couldn't even, like, really walk around and you know, was just feeling like, you know, I couldn't stop myself from drinking. And, you know, I grabbed Chris Young, Dylan Betances, and basically told him I felt like I needed to go get help. And, you know, I was going to go tell Joe, and both of them to a man said, if you feel like you needed to do this, and like I said, they had known I've been struggling with it all year, then, you know, you need to make this step. And if you can do this and pull this off, then you're going to help a lot of people. So once they both told me that, it just made sense for me to go in and get help. And that's what I did. Joe right away, you know, he was like, let's figure this out. You know, had that conversation gone differently, or, you know, had he said, you know, let's try to wait until, you know, the end of the season or till the playoffs is over, you know, maybe, you know, it sets me on a different course. But Joe right away, you know, realized I need to make this decision for my family, and he was all for it.
Yeah, you mentioned going in and telling Joe. You're referring to Joe Girardi, who was the Yankees manager. You know, you anticipated a future in baseball, you know, hopefully as a sober athlete down the line. And, you know, baseballs or players are often kind of superstitious. They're creatures of habit. They have routines before games and after games, you know, what they eat, you know, what they wear, all that kind of stuff. Was drinking such a part of your routine that you worried you might not be able to pitch effectively without it?
Yeah, it was. It was a big part of it. So much a part of it that I didn't know if I was going to be able to pitch without it. And, you know, but, you know, having a chance to go into rehab and, you know, really figure out, you know, why I was drinking or the reasons why, and sitting down and taking that time, I think it helped me realize that I didn't need to drink, you know, to pitch. And to be honest, you know, as I got into my late 30s, you know, I don't think I could have drank the way I did and pitched anyway. You know, with my knee the way it was and my body trying to recover, my shoulder, you know, it would have set me up in bad places to not be able to perform the way I did at the end of my career.
You went back to the game, you know, and you're aging as an athlete. You had problems with your knee and your shoulder. I tell you, some of the pain that you describe experiencing on the mound, I'm amazed that you could get through it. Do you think you were a better, a smarter pitcher without alcohol?
I think I was just better at that time and smarter just as a pitcher, you know, being 15, 16 years in, you know, and having a chance to sit with Andy Pettit and learn from Andy Pettit. But yeah, I mean, for sure, being sober and having a clear mind let me be able to repeat my delivery and be able to get out there. I, like I said, I mean, the amount of drinking that I did, to try to do that in my late 30s, there's no way I would have been able to pitch a baseball season. So yeah, I mean, being able to get sober and have my body back, you know, it helped me get through those last 4 years.
People who want to can look at the documentary Under the Grapefruit Tree and see your last game. You want to tell us about the circumstances under which you left that game?
Yeah, very last pitch that I threw. You know, I come into the game against the Astros. in the playoffs in 2019, and you know, very last pitch that I threw, I ripped my capsule on my shoulder, my labrum, my rotator cuff, my bicep, everything. And I had been in some pain pretty much that whole year. And then that last pitch, you know, it ripped up everything. And, you know, I was on the mound at Yankee Stadium, and you know, it was the first time that I really kind of heard the crowd and, you know, got a standing ovation. And, you know, it worked out. But I feel like for me, it worked out the best way it could have, because I'm such a competitor and I love to play the game, that I would have still tried to been playing after I announced my retirement. So the fact that I did get hurt and, you know, not able to pitch no more, I think helped me out.
CC Sabathia, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
CC Sabathia spent 19 years pitching in the big leagues with the Indians, Brewers, and Yankees. His memoir is called Till the End. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.